win a cup wherever he played once wearing the C. That's no coincidence. Or you look at other guys who seem to have a knack for scoring game-winning goals in the playoffs. It's true that playoff hockey is different, and some guys just have another gear when the regular season is over. The year we won our fourth cup, Kevin Lowe broke his wrist in the first round and played the rest of that spring in a cast. Every team has a player like that. At the end of the day, the prize is too big not to give that kind of effort. In big games, the stars are bigger targets than ever. One reason third-line guys often end up being the heroes is that the first-line guys have been shut down by smart coaching and stifling defense. In my mind, what makes a star player a superstar is the ability to play through that in big games. To me, that's Marc Messier. The bigger the game, the better he played. Whether it was a Canada Cup final or a Game 7, he could bring the energy and the passion to a whole new level. Just about the biggest compliment I can offer to a hockey player is to compare him to Gordie Howe. And to me, Mark is the closest I've ever seen. He was a big, strong guy. As a center, he could bull guys right off the face-off dot. Or he could just grind the other team down over the course of a game. I've taken many face-offs against Marc Messier, and I can't see how anyone would describe it as fun. Like Gordie, Mark could create space for himself with the liberal use of his stick, and if someone took issue with that, he was more than happy to settle the dispute with his gloves off. If you're playing in the NHL, you're probably not an easy person to intimidate. But Mark could scare guys. But also, like Gordie, Messier became more of a finesse player as his career went on. It's hard to go from being a pure power forward to playing a finesse game. But those two guys did it. They were among the best passers and playmakers in the game. That just comes down to a tremendous hockey sense, which is another of the best compliments you can pay a guy. It's a pretty impressive thing to win a one-on-one battle in the NHL with pure skill or speed or strength. But it's even harder to slow things down and beat a whole team just by seeing the ice better. Those two could do that. Mark's leadership skills are no secret. He won the Conn Smythe in 1984, so it's pretty clear what he meant to the Oilers. But I think that was magnified when he was with the Rangers. Today, it's common for players to guarantee a win. But nobody did that in 1994. With the Rangers falling behind 3-2 in their Eastern Conference Series against New Jersey, however, Mark told the media that his team wasn't done. Then he came out and played the game of his life. Remember, the Rangers were trailing going into the third period. Their season was almost over. Then Mark took a pass as he was heading up the middle, powered in on the backhand, and found the net behind Marty Brodeur. He went on to score two more to complete the hat trick. But that backhand goal defined his career. Power, finesse, and the ability to come through when he had to. Some people thought that his comment to the media was cocky or selfish, but that wasn't Mark at all. He was just the opposite. He was putting all the pressure on himself and letting the other guys just play their game. If he hadn't made that prediction, the whole team would have felt like chokers. After he made it, it was all on him. Every New Jersey player wanted more than ever to shut him down. Every reporter would have mocked him if the Rangers had lost. He knew that. And he knew that would be good for the team. That's real leadership. Standing up and yelling in the dressing room before the game doesn't make you a leader. Being unselfish does. I wasn't on that 1994 Rangers team, of course. But I've seen his unselfishness firsthand over the years. If I had a 3-goal game with the Oilers, Mark was as happy as if he'd scored those goals himself. He was genuinely pleased for a teammate who had a good game. We are still good friends, and we laugh when we read about teammates who don't get along or who asked to be traded because of poison in the dressing room. For us, it was the opposite. We made each other better. Glenn Sather used to play our lines against each other in practice. How could I not become a better hockey player lining up against one of the best of all time almost every day? I consider myself lucky to have played with him. I know we wouldn't have won the 1984 Canada Cup without him. And in my mind, he is the definition of what it takes to win a Stanley Cup. As a hockey player, the thing you remember most is your first Stanley Cup. It's a feeling you wish every guy in the NHL could experience at some point. But the fact that not everybody gets that chance is part of what makes it so special. There are some pretty special players who never got to lift the cup. You think of really well-respected guys like Marcel Dion and Daryl Sittler. Everyone would love to see Jerome McGinley finally win one after coming so close. And it was almost a relief when Ray Bourque finally did. The cup has gone missing a few times. In 1905, on the way to a party, the Ottawa Silver Sevens placed some bets on how far it could slide and drop-kicked it onto the frozen Rideau Canal. In 1923, King Clancy took it home to show his dad, but the following season the Senators forgot he had it and drove themselves crazy looking for it. In 1924, the Canadiens were on their way over to their owner, Leo Dondurand's home, with a cup, when they got a flat tire. They placed the cup on the sidewalk while they changed the flat and accidentally left it behind when they drove off. In 1970, the original collar beneath the bowl was stolen from the Hockey Hall of Fame and then found 7 years later in the back of a Toronto store. In 1987, when we won the cup against Philadelphia, we didn't have a formal after party. We'd won three cups in 4 years, so we celebrated at the rink, and then we all went to a nightclub called Barry T's in the south end of Edmonton. We were having a great time. The whole team was there. About 2 hours into the night, we looked over and the Stanley Cup was just sitting at the end of the bar. No players were around it, just the odd fan that would come up and take a picture with it. Later on, our goalie, Andy Moog, and his wife decided to head home. Andy picked up the cup from the end of the bar and held it over his head while the guys cheered and slapped him on the back. Then the party went on. Andy carried the cup out the door, put it in his trunk, and drove home. 3 hours later, he got up and drove his little daughter, Alyssa, to school. He got out, opened his trunk, grabbed the cup, and carried it in. He put it on the office counter and said, "I'll be back after school," and went home to bed. About lunchtime, the Oilers' public relations director, Bill Toulet, called up. He'd been calling the whole team, and finally he got to number 35. He said, "Andy, do you know where the cup is?" When Andy said, "Yeah, it's at my daughter's school," he made Bill's day. No one wants to be the guy who loses the cup. The next year, 1988, in September, the NHL hired Phil Pritchard, the keeper of the cup, and it hasn't been lost since. Chapter 9. Vezina. The Stanley Cup meant so much to Georges Vezina that on March 30th, 1916, the night the Canadiens won their first cup, and the night his second son was born, and only a few hours old, Georges named him Marcel Stanley. His older son, Jean-Jules Vezina, had been the first baby to have his picture taken while sitting in the cup. Today, just about every guy with a baby does it. I might have done it too if I'd thought of it. Georges grew up in Chicoutimi, a small, very beautiful French-Canadian town of 6,000 people, 2 hours straight north of Quebec City in the middle of the northern wilderness. It's very close to the town of Peribonka, where my 1984 Canada Cup line mate, Michel Goulet, grew up. In February 1910, the Canadiens were on the road and stopped into Chicoutimi to play a group of locals from the Price Brothers pulp mill. Everyone thought it would be an easy win, but the Canadiens couldn't get the puck past the goalie, a guy named Georges Vezina. At 23 years old, he wasn't a very big guy, only 5'6 and 165 pounds. And he'd only been skating for 5 years. He learned to play hockey in his boots. When they returned home, Montreal's goalie, Joe Katerinich, convinced the team to give Vezina a tryout. By December, they signed Georges for $800 a year. Georges Vezina was the first goalie to record an NHL shutout. He did it against the Toronto Blue Shirts on February 18, 1918. He led the league in wins that year. At that time, Montreal was the unhealthiest city in Canada. More than 85% of the people rented their homes, many of them in sprawling slums. The only health care and welfare available were through religious charities. The death rate from tuberculosis alone was more than 200 per 100,000. There were about 618,500 people living in the metropolitan area. That means more than 1,200 men, women, and children died from TB each year. Somewhere along the way, Georges Vezina contracted the disease, but he kept it to himself and kept playing. Rangers legend Frank Boucher said that Georges was pale and frail-looking, but remarkably good with his stick. He'd pick off more shots with it than he did with his glove. He stood upright in the net and scarcely ever left his feet. He always wore a toque, a small knitted hat with no brim and Montreal colors, blue, blanc et rouge. That toque was so famous that Canadiens goalie José Théodore wore one over his mask for the 2003 Heritage Classic as a tribute. Goalies are all different. Vezina was one of the calm ones. Boucher remembered him as the coolest man I ever saw. He stayed so unruffled in the net that the newspapers called him the Chicoutimi Cucumber. His teammates said that before a game, he'd sit by himself in the locker room, smoking his pipe and reading the paper. Grant Fuhr was like that. He had that same cool demeanor. If Grant said 3 words in a sentence, it was a busy day. When he was in net, Grant didn't do much talking. He'd bark once in a while, "Arrgh!" or holler out, "Hey!" But he was always steady and calm under fire. A calm goalie has an incredible effect on a team. I remember in the 1987 finals, we lost game 6, 3-2 in Philadelphia. We had 2 days to get ready for game 7. We had a light skate on the second day, then everyone went their own way. After morning skate on game day, one of the reporters asked Grant what he had done to prepare for the big game. He surprised everyone by telling the group that he had played golf. "How many holes?" someone asked. 54, was his answer. Someone asked why, suggesting that 3 rounds of golf was a bit much before a big game. "Because it was getting too dark to play 72, was his reply. And the guys loved it. That sense of calm was just what we needed to hear. And we weren't disappointed. He stood on his head in a 3-1 win. That fall, I was sitting on the bench at the Canada Cup in the second game against the Soviets. It was 5-5 late in the third, and Grant was in net. The guy beside me on the bench wasn't an Oiler, so I turned to him to reassure him. "They've got 5, I told him, "but we could play another 7 periods and they wouldn't get another." And they didn't. Grant was probably the greatest athlete I ever played with. He's the 10th winningest goalie in regular season, 3rd in playoff wins in NHL history. If it wasn't for him, I don't think I'd have 4 championship rings. In Georges Vezina's whole career, from 1910 to 1925, he never missed a game. He made 328 consecutive starts in the regular season and 39 more in the playoffs. By November 28, 1925, Georges had lost 35 pounds during training camp. The Canadiens were playing the Pittsburgh Pirates, a new team in the NHL. And that night, Georges showed up paler and more haggard-looking than usual. He stopped shots in the first period, but left the ice coughing up blood. He stayed in the dressing room with only his pads off, hoping he'd feel good enough to go out again. But he was having a tough time breathing, and with a temperature of 102, he could barely move. The next day he saw his doctor. Tuberculosis was the diagnosis. Vezina came back one more time to pick up his sweater. Leo Dondurand told reporters that Vezina had tears running down his cheeks, and so did everyone else who was there. He returned to Chicoutimi and died the next spring on March 27, 1926. It was a sad day for hockey. At the start of the next season, the team owners, Leo Dondurand, Leo Letourneau, and Joseph Katerinich, honored their goalie by donating the Vezina Trophy to the NHL. It was awarded to the goalie who let in the fewest goals. In 1987-88, Grant Fuhr played all 9 Canada Cup games. We beat the Soviets to win the tournament. And then he played 75 regular season and 19 playoff games to win the Stanley Cup against the Bruins. That year, Grant won the Vezina. Chapter 10. The Lady Bing. It's one of the oldest tricks in the book. If you can't catch the guy you're chasing on the back check, it's never a bad idea to tap your stick or call for a drop pass. Every once in a while, the guy will just hand you the puck without looking. Everyone has done it, and everyone has been fooled into giving away the puck at one point or another. I say it's never a bad idea, but as with anything in hockey, eventually you're going to come face to face with the guy you tricked. In 1922, Ottawa rookie King Clancy called for a pass from Canadiens tough guy Sprague Cleghorn, then turned around and scored when he got the puck. As the teams were leaving the ice, Cleghorn called over in a friendly voice, "Hey, Clancy!" Clancy turned and Cleghorn knocked him out cold. In the stands that night was Lady Evelyn Byng, wife of the Governor General of Canada. Lord Byng had been in command of the 100,000 Canadian troops who fought at Vimy Ridge and finally figured out how to crack the previously impregnable German defenses. It was one of the most important battles of the First World War, and certainly the most famous in Canadian history. After the war, Byng was knighted, and in 1921 he was appointed Governor General. When the Byngs moved to Ottawa, they both became big hockey fans. The Senators were their team. Lady Byng gave her staff strict instructions not to book any events for Saturday nights because she hated to miss the Senators' games. Still, what Lady Byng saw often horrified her. Back then, hockey was known as hell on ice. She hated to see fans throwing garbage and coins on the ice and stopping the game, and she cringed at some of the violence that was endemic back then. If you believed in the British sense of gentlemanly fair play, you probably saw room for improvement in the NHL of the 1920s. Sprague Cleghorn had been a key man in Ottawa's 2 Stanley Cup winning teams in 1919-20 and 20-21. He hit like a train and could move the puck. But most people thought of him as a tough guy. The Senators' owner and manager, Tommy Gorman, said that Sprague was always ready, willing, and eager to swing fists or stick any time. Perhaps he was a little too ready. Cleghorn was traded to Montreal in 1921. Whether he was bitter about the trade or just in a bad mood, Cleghorn was a one-man wrecking crew when the Habs visited the heavily favored Senators on February 1, 1922. In the first period, Cleghorn sent Ottawa's left winger, Eddie Girard, to the hospital with a stick just over his eye as he skated by. Next, he went after Senators superstar Frank Niebuhr and broke his arm. In the third period, he ran Cy Denneny into the boards from behind and sent him off on a stretcher. All 3 players missed the next 2 games. Because of how Gerard was cut, Cleghorn was accused of playing with a nail on his stick. The Ottawa police wanted to arrest him, but nobody could prove it. Like the rest of the crowd that night that booed every time Cleghorn came on for a shift, Lady Bing was upset. She was a fan of Frank Nibers. A lot of people were. Fans followed him the way they would Gordie Howe and Maurice Richard in the years ahead. No one wanted to see a guy like that getting his arm broken. As it happened, Niber was also her neighbor. The Senators won the Stanley Cup the next year, 1922-23, and then lost to the Canadiens in the 23-24 playoffs. In 1924-25, when the ownership changed hands, they failed to make the playoffs for the first time in 7 years. That spring, Frank Niber received an invitation to drop by the Governor General's residence, Rideau Hall, to see Lady Bing. He came in, and she walked him into the drawing room where there was a tall silver cup on a marble stand. She said, "Frank, you think the NHL would allow Lord Bing and me to donate this cup as an annual award to the player who shows great ability, gentlemanly conduct, and sportsmanlike behavior?" Frank told her they'd probably be happy to. She nodded and then asked him to pick it up. "Well then, I present this trophy to you, Frank Niber, as the most sportsmanlike player for 1925. That probably marked a change in the game. Fighting was part of the game back then. Every player was fair game. It was a part of my era too. But thanks to skill players in the 1920s, like Frank Niber and Frank Boucher, who were part of the first generation of hockey players who didn't want to fight, a code started to develop. If you don't go looking for trouble, no one should expect you to fight. I played with and against so many of them. Peter Driscoll, Dave Semenko, Marty McSorley, Dave Hunter. All the Hunter brothers were gamers. These were honest, tough guys. People have the wrong idea about them. They think they're crazy or that they like violence. That's very rarely the case. They weren't cheap shot guys. They weren't trying to run guys after whistles. Don Cherry always argues that if players are allowed to fight, they'll police themselves. He says tough guys fight tough guys in order to calm the waters. And he's right. What people don't realize is that 90% of the time two tough guys fight, they're all fired up like boxers, but they aren't angry. They fight for a reason, to protect a teammate, or to change the momentum of a game. They actually prevent violence. If there is a beef out there, it's better to settle it right there. It's when things go unaddressed, or a score is lopsided, that a game gets out of hand. A lot of times, the tough guys are among the smartest guys on the team. They are strategists. They're always some of the most popular guys in the locker room, and often the funniest. Players respect the fact they are risking their necks to protect the team. It's probably no coincidence that fans love them too. But no one needs to see the Frank Nibers of the league fighting. Lady Bing thought guys like that should be allowed to play the game, and she was right. The same goes for Frank Boucher. By 1935, Boucher had won the Bing 7 times. Lady Bing asked him to keep it, and she sent to England for a replica. Boucher thanked her, but asked her to take him out of the running in the future so other guys could have a chance at winning. "I've had the honor of winning the Lady Bing 5 times, and it means a lot to me. It's a privilege to follow great pioneers of the game like Frank Niber and Frank Boucher, Sil Apps, and Dave Keon. But I can tell you it's not always easy to keep your cool." The first year the Flyers won the Stanley Cup was 1973-74. They were called the Broad Street Bullies by then. I was 13, and I remembered my dad saying, "This is not good for you." I said, "What do you mean it's not good for me?" He said, "Hockey's going to go in that direction. Now the Flyers have won, other teams will imitate them." My dad was right. in the NHL, in probably every sport, we're just a big herd of cows. When one team does it, every team does it. It's like morning skate. When I was with the Oilers and we were winning, we did a morning skate. So everybody started doing a morning skate. Then last year, Joe Quenneville's Blackhawks won the Stanley Cup. And he doesn't do them, so nobody does the morning skate. Everybody is looking for that edge, and you always look to the team that's most successful. I tried fighting a couple of times, but my fights were just kind of funny. On December 22, 1982, we were playing the North Stars. That night I was presented with the Sports Illustrated Sportsman of the Year. I was pretty excited about it. A guy flew in from New York, and he got on the microphone and gave a speech about what a great role model I was for the game. Basically, he said I was getting the award because I didn't fight. Second shift, I was in a fight with Neil Broughton. To this day, I have no idea why. It was just one of those things. We were just kind of grabbing each other. It was silly. I looked over at him and we both started laughing. I came back to the bench and Dave Semenko said, "That was the worst catfight I've ever seen." Neil and I were both sitting in the penalty box. 2 years later, we were playing in Chicago on March 7th, 1984. Bob Murray, who now runs the Ducks, was an honest player. He played hard, but he was always fair to me. Back then, teams would get a guy to just dog me, and I got frustrated. Bob was just doing his job, but I got mad at him and dropped my gloves at center ice. He grabbed me and flipped me over. I was on the ground staring up at him, and he had his fist over my face. He said, "Don't move. I'm not gonna hit you." I said, "Okay, I'm not moving." But out of the corner of my eye, I could see four sets of legs come over the boards. Messier, Dave Semenko, Dave Hunter, and Donnie Jackson. I yelled, "Hey, nobody touch him. He didn't do anything." And I saw the legs all swing back onto the bench. When you look at the guys who have won the Lady Byng, one thing they have in common is that they were incredibly unselfish. Dave Keon, Johnny Busick, Jean Ratel, Butch Goring, and Marcel Dion had to keep their composure in a league that was pretty wild by today's standards. In the 80s, my teammate Yari Curry won it, Mike Bossy won it three times with the Islanders, and Joey Mullen won it twice with the Flames. It goes on, from Ron Francis to Paul Kariya to Joe Sakic to Pavel Datsyuk to Marty Saint-Louis. There was never any question about how hard any of those played. They just knew how hard you can play and stay within the rules. Nobody illustrates the spirit of the Lady Byng better than Stan Mikita, possibly the best center of the 1960s. When he came into the league, he played on a line with Ted Lindsay, easily one of the most feared guys in the league. Lindsay advised the rookie to earn respect by playing with a mean streak. So that's what Mikita did. And he ended up being nearly as feared as Lindsay, until one day he came home from the rink, and his four-year-old daughter asked him why he had been sent to sit by himself after the whistle, when the rest of his line went to sit with all their friends on the bench. When he couldn't offer a good explanation for himself, he vowed to play a cleaner game. He went on to earn the Lady Byng for his efforts. Today's NHL is policed by TV. Before TV, we would go in the locker room at the end of the period, and somebody would say, "Did you see that guy cross-check our guy over the head?" And the next period, someone would straighten it out. Gordie Howe used to say, "Get a number and get him next time." Well, you can't get a number and get him next time anymore, because there are now two referees out there. So the officials have a much better sense of what is going on behind the play. There are probably 8 TV cameras in the stands. When something happens, it's carefully examined by 4 NHL employees who go through replay after replay from lots of angles in super slow motion. And if the professional cameras don't get it, somebody will have it on a phone. There will always be a place for tough guys who can play the game like our Oilers enforcers, Dave Semenko and Marty McSorley. And fans will always love skill guys who are willing to drop their gloves, like Brendan Shanahan or Wendell Clark. Who will forget Vincent LeCavalier and Jerome Iginla going at it in the 2004 final? Both of those players inspired their benches. In today's game, you look at a team like Anaheim, which doesn't really need a guy to protect its stars because Corey Perry and Ryan Getzlaff don't need anybody protecting them. Or Los Angeles. Kopitar doesn't need anyone to protect him. Doughty doesn't need anyone. And Milan Lucic certainly doesn't either. It wasn't that long ago that both benches would empty, and it would be a free-for-all. But now some of these guys are more like Bobby Orr and Gordie Howe. They can take care of themselves. I really think in the next maybe 10, 15 years, you won't see fighting in hockey. You don't see it in European hockey or in college. More and more guys are coming into the league without ever having fought. For most of our game's history, fighting just felt normal. The time is coming when not fighting will feel just as normal. It's slowly being weeded out of the game. I think that would have made Lady Bing very happy. Chapter 11. First All-Star Game. Eddie Shore changed the game in a lot of ways. As one of the game's first true superstars, he actually helped shape the game we know today. But there is one defining moment everyone involved wished had never happened. Shore was a generational talent on the blue line. He has one more Hart Trophy to his name than Bobby Orr. So there was no doubting his talent. And everyone remembers how tough he was. In his first year as a Bruin, Shore got into a fight with Billy Couture in practice and lost part of his ear. When the trainer refused to sew it back on, Eddie found a doctor who would. He refused to have it frozen and instead used a little mirror to watch the doctor reattach it. It sounds like a made-up story, but I believe it because I saw things like that with my own eyes. Just ahead of a game in L.A., Marty McSorley yanked his own broken tooth out with a pair of pliers. Our captain in Edmonton, Lee Fogelin, did the same thing with a coat hanger. Shore was as tough as they come. In 1933, the Leafs were playing the Bruins at Boston Garden in front of 12,000 fans. It was a rough game, lots of penalties. King Clancy, Red Horner, and Ace Bailey were sent out to kill a 5-on-3. Ace was a great stick handler for the Leafs. His manager, Conn Smythe, called him one of the smoothest men in hockey. Bailey played 8 seasons for the Leafs. 1 year he was the leading scorer in the league with 22 goals and 32 points in 44 games. He was looking at many more years among the league's best players. Bailey won the faceoff and ragged the puck for a full minute. He won a second faceoff, ran a bit more time off the clock, then dumped it into the Bruins zone. Shore picked it up and started to break up the ice when King Clancy got a piece of him with a hip check and turned the puck over. Shore got up and went after the first blue and white sweater he saw. It belonged to Ace Bailey. He took a run at Bailey and caught him hard from the side. Bailey was airborne and came down hard on the right side of his head. He was out cold. Bailey's teammate, Red Horner, a future Hall of Famer who happened to be the league leader in penalty minutes, punched Shore in the mouth and sent him to the ice. Both teams came over the boards ready to go, but when they saw Shore was unconscious and his head was bleeding and Bailey was blue and convulsing, they cooled down pretty quickly. The Leafs carried Bailey into the locker room, and the Bruins carried Shore off to theirs. Conn Smythe was trying to make his way to Ace through some of the fans who'd left their seats and come down into the tunnel for a closer look. One fan named Leonard Kenworthy was pointing at Bailey, yelling that he was faking. Smythe lost it. He punched the guy in the nose and broke his glasses. He was arrested right then and there. King Clancy cleared the rest of the fans away with his stick. Shore got stitched up and headed over to the Leafs' dressing room to see Bailey. He told him he was sorry. Bailey replied, "It's all part of the game, Eddie." That was the last thing Bailey would remember for the next 10 days. He was rushed to the Audubon Hospital in Boston, where surgeons drilled a hole in his skull to relieve the pressure on his swollen brain. They gave him less than a 50-50 chance to live, and a priest was called in to give him last rites. Frank Selke had to have his father intercepted when he arrived from Toronto with a gun to kill Shore. Bailey pulled through, but he wasn't the same. It took a year for him to get his full functions back, and he had a hospital bill that ran over $1,000. At 30, hockey was over for him, and he was out of a job. To raise money for Bailey and his family, the NHL Board of Governors arranged for the first benefit All-Star game to be played between the Leafs and the rest of the league's star players on Valentine's Day, 1934. The money helped Ace tremendously. They did the same thing 3 years later after Howie Morenz died. Morenz left behind three kids, Howie Jr., who was 8, Donald, who was 6, and Marlene, who was 3. His widow, Mary, was just 26 years old and faced a tough challenge to raise three kids on her own. The league arranged a game between a team full of Canadiens and Maroons and an all-star team at the Forum on November 2, 1937. But the money went only so far. Mary had to find a job, so she moved back in with her parents and put her three kids in an orphanage. She spent hours on the trolley to see them every Sunday and never missed a visit. Eddie Shore was suspended indefinitely, but was eventually given 16 games for that hit. Conn Smythe settled a lawsuit with Kentworthy, the fan he had slugged, for $200 plus $100 for his own lawyer. He said it was the best $300 he ever spent. At the All-Star game, Shore and Bailey shook hands at center ice. Bailey was wearing a top coat, fedora, and dark glasses, but you could see a 6-inch scar from the top of his ear straight up into his hairline. It covered the silver plate the doctors had to put in his head. The Leafs retired Ace's jersey number 6 that night. It was the first time a number was retired in the NHL. Hockey's past has a way of finding its way into hockey's future. Marlene Morenz, Howie's baby daughter, would grow up to marry Boom Boom Geoffrion, one of the greatest right-wingers in an era that included Maurice Richard and Gordie Howe. Though he played the point on the power play, along with Doug Harvey, in part because of his legendary shot, and in part because Richard was on the right wing, playing with Jean Béliveau and Dickie Moore. Back then, penalized players served the full 2 minutes. That line could score a couple goals or more with a man advantage. Finally, the league had to take mercy on opposing teams and let the penalized player out of the box after a goal. I played against their son, Danny Geoffrion, when I was with the Oilers and he was with the Jets. Danny's son, Blake Geoffrion, played at the University of Wisconsin and was the 2010 Hobey Baker winner, the top college player in the country. Blake was drafted in the second round by the Nashville Predators and traded to the Canadiens in 2011-12. In November 2012, he was playing with the AHL farm team, the Hamilton Bulldogs, at the Bell Center in Montreal. In the first period, his fourth shift going down on the left wing side, he was checked hard by the Syracuse Crunch defenseman, J.P. Côté. As Blake went down, Côté's skate caught him above his left ear, causing a depressed skull fracture that required a 4-hour emergency surgery. The doctors removed all the broken bone and replaced the shattered part with a 2.5-inch plate held in his head with 5 screws. At 25 years old, Blake's hockey playing days were done. But he has great hockey sense, and he's a great kid. Today, he scouts for the Columbus Blue Jackets. Afterward, Cote got hold of Blake and said, "I'm really sorry for what happened." And Blake said, "It was a good clean hit, JP. No hard feelings." There wasn't anything more that needed to be said. Chapter 12. Fire in His Eyes. It's hard to believe, but in the 1930s, hockey didn't draw much of a crowd in Montreal. Some nights at the Forum, there might be a couple of thousand fans. Then, in 1942, Maurice Richard came along. Ken Reardon, who had come back to play defense for the Canadiens after his time in uniform, was playing on an Army team in an exhibition game against the Habs when he first encountered Richard. "I see this guy skating at me with wild, bloody hair, the way he had it then, eyes just outside the nut house. I'll take this guy," I said to myself. Well, he went around me like a hoop around a barrel. Everybody always talked about the look in Richard's eyes when he had the puck and was coming in on the net. Glenn Hall, who played against him in Detroit and then Chicago, said that his eyes were all lit up, flashing and gleaming like a pinball machine. It was terrifying. The Rocket got his nickname in his second season with the Canadiens. Left winger Ray Getliff watched him pick up an Elmer Locke pass at the blue line and head for the net. He said, "That kid just went in there like a rocket." Dink Carroll, a longtime sports reporter for the Montreal Gazette, heard him say it and reported it in the paper. The rest is history. Dick Irvin was the coach of the Canadiens. Elmer Locke played the first part of the 1942-43 season with Tony Demers and Maurice Richard. This line was called the Broken Bones Line, or the Ambulance Line, because the three of them were so injury-prone. Irvin replaced Demers with the Rocket and came up with the punchline, Elmer Locke, Toe Blake, and Richard, in January 1943. They won the Stanley Cup that year. In his third year with the Canadiens, Richard became the first NHL player to score 50 goals in 50 games. That was 1944-45. The season before, he was the first to score 12 goals in an NHL playoff year. The Forum was now filling up with fans. Richard was always the first guy on at practice and the last guy off. He'd stay to skate and shoot. He worked to develop speed, accuracy, and the hardest shot in the league. He had a bomb off the rush, and would also set up in the slot for the one-timer like Mike Bossy and Bobby Hull. Goalies like Glenn Hall didn't wear masks back then. It wouldn't have been easy to stand in front of that cannon. The Rocket wasn't a huge man, 5'10", 170 to 180 pounds. But the strongest NHLers aren't usually monsters like NFL linebackers. There aren't many guys who can move Sidney Crosby off the puck. There weren't many players who were eager to tango with Wendell Clark. And there was almost no one as fast or as strong as Pavel Bure. They were all about Richard's size. He had incredibly strong arms and legs and a huge chest. These names also give a pretty good sense of what it would be like to try to stop Richard. He didn't look for fights, but he would drive so hard to the net that guys would have to bend the rules just to slow him down. And he would retaliate. If he wanted to get to the net, he was going to get to the net. There's a famous story about big defenseman Earl Seibert, who was with Detroit at the time. This is the same player who broke Howie Morenz's leg. Detroit and Montreal were playing at the Olympia when Seibert jumped on the Rocket's back to stop him. But Richard just kept on coming. He put the puck in the net, and then he shook his shoulders like a big bear, and Earl went flying. When Seibert got back to the bench, Jack Adams gave him grief for not taking his man. But Earl, who was a 200-pound player, told Adams that any guy who could carry him in from the blue line to the net and score deserved the goal. The Wings and the Canadiens played each other 12 to 14 times a season, And although Gordie Howe and the Rocket respected each other, they didn't like each other. In Gordie's third NHL season, January 29, 1949, and their only recorded fight, King Clancy was the referee. He let them go at it while a group of players surrounded the two of them. Gordie landed a couple of punches, and Richard ended up on the ice. Clancy tied Gordie up, so his line mate Sid Abel came up to Rocket, stood over him, and made some remarks. Richard got up and broke Sid Abel's nose. The two teams hated each other so much that the police had to stand by at the Westmount station in Montreal when both teams had to catch the same train. In the 1952-53 season, the Wings finished number one, 15 points ahead of the Canadiens. In the last game of the season, they were up against the Canadiens. Gordie had accumulated 49 goals and was going for number 50. At that point, the Rocket was the only NHL player to ever have scored 50 in a season. Gordie had a couple of good chances in that final game, but Canadiens left winger Bert Olmsted was all over him all game. Gordie didn't score. Jerry McNeil was in goal for the Canadiens, and when they got back to the dressing room, he said, "Well, Rock, he's got to start at one again." I know a little what they must have felt about Richard's record. Glenn Sather used to push us as individuals to pursue individual awards. You could be totally unselfish and still strive to be the best. I think that's because he had played in Boston and Montreal with guys like Orr and Béliveau. He knew that players who wanted to be the best made their teams better. So in training camp, he would say, "This year I want to win the Stanley Cup, and I want to win the scoring race, and I want to win the Norris," and so on. In his view, individual honors are team awards, so I can see why the Canadiens wanted to protect Richard. His record was theirs, too. On December 29, 1954, in Toronto, in the last minute of the first period, the Rocket scored his 401st goal, and the crowd gave him a standing ovation. He was 15 points ahead of Gordie in overall scoring that season. And then in the third period, with 5 minutes left, 23-year-old Bob Bailey, who was just up from the Leafs farm team, the Pittsburgh Hornets, and trying to make a name for himself, went after the Rocket. During the fight, Bailey tried to gouge Richard's eyes. The linesmen separated them, but the Rocket was furious. He somehow got a stick and went after Bailey, but one of the linesmen, George Hayes, tried to stop him. The crowd was booing. The referee, Red Story, gave Maurice 5 for fighting and 2 10-minute misconducts. A few months later, on March 13th, things got even uglier. Richard and former teammate Hal Lako got into a stick-swinging incident that quickly spiraled out of control. The linesmen jumped in to break it up, and one of them, Cliff Thompson, held the Rocket down. The Rocket later said that this action opened him up to a few punches from Lako. In a move he may have regretted later, Doug Harvey pulled Thompson off Richard, who then grabbed another stick. Hal Lako covered up as the Rocket came after him. Fleming said it was at this point the fight wasn't fun anymore. The crowd went silent. The Montreal Gazette reported that Thompson tried to intervene again, and the Rocket nailed him against the boards. First of all, you've got to be courageous to be a linesman, because the game is so fast and players are so strong. You may not have to be quite as fast, but you've got to be at least as strong. Today, if you hit an official, that will cost you 20 games. Back then, it was up to the league president, Clarence Campbell. He suspended Richard for the rest of the season and the playoffs. That would be like taking Peyton Manning or Tom Brady out of the Super Bowl. Habs fans were furious. The Canadiens and Detroit Red Wings were tied for first place when they played at the Montreal Forum 4 nights later. Clarence Campbell was in the rink, and fans threw tomatoes, eggs, and programs at him. When someone threw a tear gas canister into the crowd, the fire chief ordered Canadiens manager Frank Selke to clear the building. And so Selke had to forfeit the game. As 15,000 people left the building, the bars and taverns were emptying at the same time, and some of them started to riot. They picked up bottles and huge chunks of ice and started breaking windows. They overturned newsstands and kiosks and cars and looted shops along St. Catherine Street. The Canadiens lost the Stanley Cup to Detroit in the seventh game, and missing the final three games of the regular season took away the Rockets' chance of winning the Art Ross Trophy as the league's leading scorer. As it turned out, he never won the league's scoring race his entire career. Canadiens fans never forgave Clarence Campbell. On New Year's Eve, 1959, Jack Adams told the papers that the Rocket, who along with Doug Harvey formed the backbone of the Canadiens, couldn't go on forever. Richard was 39 and recovering from an injury. Adams said, when the time comes he doesn't get 20 goals, he'll hang up his skates. It turns out Richard was thinking the same thing. Richard had gained a few pounds, and that slowed him down. He also started to worry about ending up badly hurt like Howie Morenz. Maurice hadn't played a full season since severing his own Achilles tendon with his skate in November of 1957. By 1964, the NHL had a rule that every skater had to wear a plastic safety heel that CCM developed because of that injury. Canadiens GM Frank Selke tried to convince Richard that he would have at least 5 good years left if he got himself into shape. But at 39, the Rocket was ready to retire. He made the announcement at a press conference at the Queen Elizabeth Hotel on September 15, 1960. He said that the fans had started to boo him, and that was something he never wanted to happen. He'd won 8 Stanley Cups for Montreal. I am sure it was the toughest decision he ever made. It was for me. I thought I would retire an Oiler. When that didn't happen, I thought maybe I would finish my career in Los Angeles. But my ice time was dropping, I understood. I was in my mid-30s, and Coach Larry Robinson had some young players he wanted to groom for the future. But I wasn't ready to retire by any means. I loved St. Louis and thought that might be my last stop. It's Janet's hometown, and I loved playing there. We had a fantastic defense with 2 future Hall of Famers in Al McGinnis and Chris Pronger, and Grant Fuhrer was in net. I loved playing with Shane Corson and Brett Hull. Brett was the only player who ever played with, against, and for me. We brought him into Phoenix when I was coaching there. The trouble was that I was a little older when I played there, and so when my contract with them was up, I started looking for the right place to end my career. When I was a kid, there were really only 2 teams in my eyes, the Leafs and the Red Wings. The Leafs, because they were down the road from Brantford, and Detroit, because of Gordie Howe. Playing in Toronto would give me the opportunity to move back closer to my family and to finish on one of Canada's greatest teams. At the start of the 1996-97 season, the Leafs had a lot of pieces in place. They had a lineup with some good young guys like Matt Sundin, Sergei Bereson, and Frederick Modine, and some great veterans like Dougie Gilmore, Wendell Clark, and Larry Murphy. In a way, they were like the 1967 Leafs. I thought Toronto had the potential to go deep into the playoffs, as they had in 93 and 94. And if I could help the team at the same time, it would be fulfilling a boyhood dream. My agent, Mike Barnett, had known Toronto's GM, Cliff Fletcher, for a long time. Cliff consulted with their owner, Steve Stavro, who owned a grocery chain called Nob Hill Farms. But the timing was off. Steve already was under some financial pressure, and so Toronto was out. I was also interested in playing for the Canucks, but didn't approach them until Toronto was off the table. At that point, Mike and I flew on our own dime to Vancouver as a show of good faith. I loved the team, loved the city, and thought Pat Quinn was a great coach. They had a deep, talented lineup. Marty Gelinas had won a cup with the Oilers in 1990. Pavel Bure had led the league in scoring in 1993-94. And Alexander McGillney was an absolute wizard with the puck. They had defense covered with Dave Babich and Brett Hedekin. And they had goaltending in Kirk McLean and Corey Hirsch. Needless to say, Trevor Linden was a well-respected young captain who had led his team to the final in 1994. My agent Mike Barnett and Canucks GM Stan McCammon were negotiating final terms, and it got late. I went to bed pretty happy at the thought of playing for Vancouver. About 1 a.m., Stan said, "This is the best we can do. This is where we're at." Mike said, "Well, it's pretty close. We'll have an answer in the morning after breakfast." But Stan wanted an answer that night. Mike assured him the offer looked positive, but told him it was unreasonable to wake everyone up when he could get a decision first thing in the morning. Stan said, "If you don't give me an answer now, the offer's off the table." Mike came to my room and woke me up. I told him, "I like it, but I'm not going to call Janet in the middle of the night, and I'm not going to make the decision without talking to her. So if they honestly are giving me the ultimatum after we've come up here at our own expense and told them we like the offer and given our word we are not going to shop it, then it's up to them if they take it off the table. But I hope that they don't." Mike called Stan back and said, "Look, we are not attempting to do any better in negotiations. We are not taking the offer anywhere else. It's simply that Wayne's not going to bring his wife into the final decision and choice of cities and schools and their lives and all that in the middle of the night. He'll call us as soon as he gets up, so you won't need to wait long. We'll be back here very early." Stan said, "Well, I wish you would have told me otherwise." And the next morning they told us that the offer was off the table. Maybe because they were convinced we were trying to leverage their offer, they followed up by sending out a fax to all the other teams in the NHL saying that they were ceasing further negotiations to acquire my services. One of the teams who received the fax from the Canucks that morning was the New York Rangers. Mike and I were at the Seattle airport heading back to Los Angeles when he got a phone call from Dave Checketts and Neil Smith saying, "We just received this fax that Vancouver's out. Will you talk to us?" We talked to them in the Seattle airport for 45 minutes and picked it up again when we got back to Los Angeles. New York, with Mark Messier, Brian Leetch, Luke Robitaille, and Adam Graves, was a good fit. It was a really good fit. On July 21st, 1996, I signed with the Rangers. It was great being back with so many guys I had played with before. But the thing that really made it feel like I had come full circle was having Keith Acton and Craig McTavish as assistant coaches. At one point, I had a small injury that kept me out for about 10 days, so I was out skating with the coaches to stay in shape. I used to play with these guys, and now they're telling me how many laps to do. They told me 14 one way and 14 in the other. I laughed. I don't think I ever did 28 laps in Edmonton. John Muckler was there too, still making me do sprints by myself up and down the ice. Players were getting bigger and stronger and faster, and throughout my whole career, I was always one of the smaller guys. Now I was one of the older guys too, so I was still working hard. I've always had tremendous respect for every coach I've had. Hockey players have a lot of respect for each other, and it's such a physical game. In my last year, it was kind of funny. Players on the other team would be coming down the boards, and I'd hear, "Heads up," or, "Wayne, get out of the way." They were warning me. I remember thinking, okay, this is not good. In March 1999, I decided it was time to retire. The only other person who knew was Janet. I didn't want to do a city-to-city tour with 1,000 questions. I just wanted to bow out. We were playing a home game Sunday, April 18th in New York, I decided to announce my retirement the day before. New York had been so good to me, I didn't want it leaked out, but it kind of did. Thursday, April 15th, 1999, was the day of my last game in Canada, in Ottawa, against the Senators at the Canadian Tire Center. And I think it was a dead giveaway when my dad and wife and family were at the game. Jim Dolan, the owner of the Rangers, was a great guy, really nice. Saturday morning, the day before my last game, he said, "Will you meet me for coffee?" There was a little deli called Gardenia's near my place in Manhattan. We met there at 9 a.m. In those days, before the cap, the Rangers could get anybody they wanted. Jim said, "Wayne, you're still the top scorer on the team. We're going to build a stronger team here, and I want you playing for the cup in a couple years." He handed me a check for $1 million and said, "I'll give you this $1 million.